Welcome to Appaloosa Radio, where stories come alive. Appaloosa Radio is a service of the Appaloosa Springs Audio Theater.
Appaloosa Radio is pleased to introduce Nell Trustman and her collection of Broken Tree Tales. Nell Trustman was a prolific Western author who journeyed over 300,000 bumpy miles during the early 1950s to gather stories about the forgotten ghost towns of the Old West. She published many of her stories in her own magazine, The Broken Tree Tales. She pushed her red 1947 Mercury, which she named Old Bess, through washed-out gullies, up sand hills, and along long neglected wagon trails. Her only companion in her travels was her collie dog Prospector. Nell camped under the stars when the weather permitted, or slept in Old Bess when it rained or snowed. She recorded her stories wherever she happened to be on her dependable portable Royal typewriter. Appaloosa Radio has been granted exclusive rights to Nell Trustman's Broken Tree Tales.
Las Vegas likes to promote itself as Sin City, USA. It claims to offer a wide variety of pleasures that are either illegal or not available in other places. One of its hotels has a neon cowboy waving his perpetual welcome. Come hither. Spend your money. Have a good time. However, if you wanted a really good time in 1907, you would not head for Las Vegas. It was a small rail crossing with nothing to offer. No, you would head for the infamous Stingery Gulch. The pleasure pavilion financed and created by the notorious gambler Tex Rickard. In a narrow gulch, just outside the respectable mining city of Rawhide, Tex and his various partners opened over 100 saloons, and almost as many gambling dens and dance halls. He claimed that he had 24 different orchestras, and that you could listen to a different one each and every hour of the day. Nor did Tex forget the other pleasurable exchanges. He had picture postcards printed in lots of 10,000. On the postcards were photos of scantily clad women with the claim that Stingery Gulch had 600 girls on its line, all nations, all colors. Always the entrepreneurial businessman, Tex hired agents to make sure that his postcards were handed out to working men all over the West. They met ships arriving in port, greeted trainmen as they finished their shifts, visited hundreds of mining towns, went into factory lunchrooms, and were honored guests at many lodge meetings. Show the postcard at any bar, and Tex will buy you around, they encouraged would-be visitors. In the very first night of the first saloon that Tex Rickard opened in the Gulch, the bar take alone was reported in the newspapers as $2,000. Within a month that first saloon was raking in over $25,000 per week in gambling profits. It is not surprising that Rickard kept several construction crews busy 24 hours a day, using massive arc lights, building new establishments. Before World War I, the Stingery Gulch was, without doubt, Nevada's premier sin city.
The Piano Man of Stingery Gulch. A Nell Trustman story. From reading the old newspapers and talking with other Western historians, I knew the basic facts about the instant mining city of Rawhide and its neighboring den of iniquity, up the narrow gulch, but I had never met an old-timer who could fill me in on the personal stories of the people who had experienced the place. What made finding such a person even more difficult was the fact that the town of Rawhide is no more. The entire site has been obliterated by a massive open pit mine. So to find out whether there were indeed living residents of Rawhide available to interview, I did, what for me, was an unusual thing. I ran a paid ad in a number of Nevada newspapers, asking them to contact me at my post office box. About 6 weeks after my ads ran, I received my only reply. His name was George and he now lived near West Wendover, Nevada. In my reply, I made an appointment with him, and promised to pay him for his time. Our first meeting was in the casino's restaurant in West Wendover. Our remaining meetings were across the Utah border in the quieter surroundings of the small Wendover Public Library, which, it turns out, George is now the volunteer librarian for. George asked me to not use his last name. It is an ongoing thing with my former wife. As a courtesy, I have also decided to change his first name in my stories to George.
George is originally from Dresden, Germany. Die vost beautiful city in die Welt, he said in his distinctive accent. He came to the United States in 1876, when his parents migrated to Chicago. At 14, after a fight with his father, he hopped a freight train and ended up in Denver. Too much schnapps, George added. It was in Denver that George would find his career. One that would take him over much of the Old West. George became a piano man playing in saloons and brothels in various mining towns, providing snappy, happy background music in joints which would have otherwise known only sullen silence. Some of you who have only known record players and jukeboxes might ask, why would an establishment pay to have a live piano player? The short answer is that it was good for business. Music was an advertisement for an establishment, one that could be heard blocks away. Music also created a feeling of warmth and happiness, always good for selling more booze. And, most importantly, music created the business opportunity of dancing. For miners starved of all contact with women, paying a dime, or a quarter, a dance supplied much-needed human contact. Dancing with a woman who smelled of fancy French water was a welcome alternative to the sweat and the dirt and the stench of the mines. Some of the dance hall women also engaged in prostitution, but a fair number did not. Dancing with a stinky, sweaty miner was one thing. Engaging with other bodily elements was entirely another.
George told me that he had learned to play the violin from his mother, who was a very talented musician. But in the West, the only need for violins came at hoedowns and barn dances. Not the sort of music that his mother had taught him. In Denver, George met a couple of other piano men who taught him the rudimentary ropes of the business. Playing the piano was much easier than playing the violin, and the piano, in the Old West at least, was more tolerant of a beginner's mistakes. The key to success, he learned, was to never stop playing. When one tune ended, begin another. If you needed to stretch, stand up and play. If one hand became tired, play with the other. Sometimes, I would turn all the way around, and play the piano backwards, just for a change. The other key, George learned, was to play the same 10 songs over and over. The miners did not stay at the bar all night. Most would come in and have a couple of shots of rotgut and then head home and go to bed. They had to work the next day. They never noticed that it was the same music over and over.
Saturday nights were usually the busiest of the week for the saloons. Most mining towns closed the mines on Sundays, and many towns closed the saloons as well. So the partying usually went late. On Saturdays, George was usually in an establishment playing until the last patron left at dawn. But instead of going home to sleep, George would shave, put on a clean shirt, and go to church if there were services available. A Stein religion streak in me, he said.
I asked the piano man what could be tell me about Tex Rickard? Once he began, George talked for hours and hours. I knowed him good, sehr good. He liked me special and give me lots of extra jobs. George first worked for Rickard's Northern Saloon in Goldfield, Nevada. He said the place was so big that they hired three different piano men, and that on Saturday nights all three men played at once on different sides of the room. The old newspapers that I had read said that Tex Rickard had bought the Northern Saloon in Goldfield with his winnings from his adventures up in the Yukon Territory, during the Klondike Gold Rush. One of those newspapers had called Mr. Rickard the mining town's leading citizen. And there was no doubt that he was one of its richest. Tex Rickard always moved about town with a giant of a man who was both his personal bodyguard and his enforcer. Everyone just called the enforcer the German. If they owed Rickard an unpaid gambling debt, would tremble in genuine fear at the sight of the huge blonde man who seldom spoke. Seldom spoke in English, that is. George the diminutive piano man and the giant German enforcer became, over time, close friends, often conversing together in German and sometimes having a meal together at a restaurant. The giant had a name, Wilhelm Edwin Blohm, and he was from Freital, a city close to George's beloved Dresden. As Rickard's enforcer, Blohm would often be asked to take care of things. Later, he would share with George what he had done, whom he had done it to, and what he was paid for doing it. Needless to say, the new information opened George to a new range of possibilities. The more that he learned, the more he realized that he could help Tex Rickard in ways well beyond playing the piano in the Northern Saloon. At Blohm's suggestion, Rickard began giving George a variety of extra tasks. George, in turn, proved very reliable in carrying them out. Over time, the King of Sport came to be quite confident in George and made him one of his most trusted employees.
In September 1906, Tex Rickard did what many said was not possible. In less than 3 months, he put together a championship prize fight that is, today, still regarded as one of the greatest ever. And he staged the prize fight just a block from his Northern Saloon in Goldfield. To do so, he raised $30,000, all in gold coins, from the town's mine owners. Made special deals with all of the various sports gambling syndicates from New York, Chicago, New Orleans, and San Francisco. And attracted the attention and enthusiasm of the world's sporting press. All in a place nobody had ever heard of, and could get to only with the utmost difficulty. Tex Rickard may have been the most brilliant sports promoter of his generation. In staging the Goldfield fight, he had the $30,000 in gold coins stacked in piles and placed in the largest window of his saloon. Then, he sent a photograph of the stacked gold coins to the major newspapers. His championship fight made front page news. In the match, he pitted the reigning lightweight champion, Joe Gans, against a younger and more durable fighter from Denmark, named Oscar Battling Nelson. The aging Gans was one of the country's first African-American prize fighters, and his fight against Nelson was the 187th of his professional career. But at the time of the fight, Joe Gans was in dire financial difficulty, and did not have an effective manager. As a result, Battling Nelson, with the better manager, actually earned twice as much from the gate receipts as Gans did. The fight was scheduled for noon and was held in an outdoor arena that Tex's construction crews had built only days earlier. Nevada's heat was intense and the closely packed crowd brought sweltering conditions. Before the 10th round, every saloon in town had sold all its beer. As the fight wore on, the spectators shed both their coats and their shirts. The fight between Joe Gans and Oscar Nelson is credited as history's longest championship prize fight. It went a full 42 rounds. 42 rounds. 42 rounds. Clearly, from the start, Joe Gans was the superior fighter. But Nelson was durable and he often threw low blows and elbow punched when the fighters moved in tight. In the third round, Joe Gans broke his right hand and had to continue the fight with only his left. Still, Gans punched Nelson hard, knocking him down multiple times. Finally, after the 42nd round, the referee disqualified Oscar Nelson for a sequence of low blows and a couple of knee kicks.
Joe Gans won the brutal match in Goldfield, but would be dead in just over 3 years. What no one knew was that at the time of the Goldfield fight, Joe Gans was already suffering from tuberculosis, the disease that would take his life. Tex Rickard found George, the piano man, to be an invaluable assistant as he readied for the Goldfield fight. Rickard had to make all of the arrangements by telegraph, so he installed a special telegraph line in his northern saloon. One of George's many jobs during that busy time was organizing messages and replies from the various individuals. Whenever Tex Rickard snapped, "What did Mr. XX say?" George would quickly sort through the various messages and provide an almost instantaneous answer to the query. Now, Goldfield, Nevada was a nearly isolated mining community. Its only rail line was the Tonopah and Goldfield Railroad, locally called the TNG, a narrow-gauge mining railroad, not designed for passengers. The TNG had been built to haul the raw ore mined in Goldfield to the huge, coal-fired stamping mills in Tonopah. There, other rail lines brought in the coal needed to fuel the mills. One rail line ran to the Las Vegas Junction where coal cars from the Southern Pacific Railroad were routed up. The other rail line ran north to Reno where it joined the Union Pacific Main Line. It carried primarily local freight.
Other than the TNG Narrow Gauge Railroad, the only way to get to Goldfield was by a rough, often washed out, 75-mile wagon road. Staging the championship fight in Goldfield created an immense logistical problem. How to get the 25,000 sporting gents into and out of the isolated mining town? Tex tasked George with solving the problem. After some considerable thought, George came up with what he called his system. First, Tex would rent as many passenger cars as he could. Any car would do. It did not matter how old the rail car was. Nor was passenger comfort given any thought. As long as it would run, they would rent it. Then, George decided to hire as many special carriages as he could. His plan was to run carriages between the various train stations. If a passenger came from either San Francisco or Chicago, they would take the Union Pacific to Reno. Then George's special carriages would take them across town to where the freight line down to Tonopah ran. Then in Tonopah, another carriage would take him to the narrow gauge that ran into Goldfield. In Goldfield, yet another carriage would carry the gent to his hotel. If the gent came from Texas or New Orleans or Los Angeles, he would take the Southern Pacific to the Las Vegas Junction. Again, one of George's special carriages would take him to the Tonopah rail line. And in Tonopah, he also would board the narrow gauge railroad for the trip to Goldfield. Even though guests would have to get on and off multiple modes of transport, eventually they all made it to Goldfield. George's system worked, and it worked well.
Most importantly, Tex Rickard asked George to be the bellman and timekeeper for the prize fight itself. George used Rickard's $300 gold watch to keep the time for the rounds. As the 3-minute mark was reached, he would loudly clang the bell with a small wooden hammer. The arena held 25,000 spectators on its wooden benches, and nearly all sweltered in the Nevada sun. But George sat under an awning, just inches from the ring itself. George admitted to me that he did not see much of the action since he was always looking at the gold watch. But I heard it plenty and seed em both tween rounds. They was beat up somethin' terrible. Under the same awning, to his immediate right sat Tex Rickard's close friend, Mr. Wyatt Earp. Yes, that Wyatt Earp. I didn't know the ting bout em, George told me. He was just Mr. Rickard's friend. Also close by, but not under the tent, was the writer Jack London and President Teddy Roosevelt's oldest son, Kermit. By all accounts, Tex Rickard made $500,000 from the Goldfield fight. He gave George a nice bonus of $5,000, more than the piano man had made in his whole life. Just a few months after the Goldfield fight, Tex Rickard made his next play in a new strike called Rawhide and in a gulch named for a stinging fish, the Stingaree. As George remembers it, Tex Rickard bought the sporty Thomas Flyer Model 35 automobile within weeks after the big fight. It arrived by special train car all the way from its factory in Buffalo. A couple of weeks later, the famed race car driver, Gabe Schuster, arrived as Tex Rickard's personal chauffeur. Two years later, Schuster would gain worldwide fame when he won the grueling 22,000-mile New York to Paris race, a race that today is often simply called the Great Race. One frosty January morning, Tex Rickard told George to pack his suitcase because they were moving operations up to a new strike in a place called Rawhide. Gabe Schuster cranked up the Thomas Flyer. George, and the German-speaking enforcer Blom joined Tex Rickard and his chauffeur for the ride up to the place. A place of just sagebrush, not yet a town. Of course, it was the very first time that George had ever ridden in a motor car. As the Model 35 purred its way along, Rickard laid out his strategy. He had bought a large corner lot, sight unseen, in Rawhide, and he intended to build Nevada's largest saloon and dance hall on it. It would be twice the size of his very large place in Goldfield. He told the enforcer Blom to get him the girls, lots and lots of girls. Buy out as many working banyos as you can, offer the madams top dollar to relocate. Promise ornate facilities with electric lights and flush lavatories. We'll give them first-rate protection and put them on a commission system. Everything will be up and up. He also told the giant German to find him a good mama who could run everything. She needed to run a clean place and make her girls take regular baths. Tex Rickard did not want any boozed-up women and no pipe smokers. We're going to be a top-shelf place. The men will pay more for our kind of entertainment. Now, George, Tex Rickard said to the piano man. In the new place, I want an orchestra, not just a rinky-tinky piano. I want you to get me a full orchestra. From now on, we'll call you Marvelous Maestro George. Our ladies will dance only to the finest waltzes. Real upscale. And the dance floor, it is going to be real marble, not a bunch of pine boards and nails. Tex Rickard had a knack for seeing big, even in a place like Rawhide where there was literally nothing but sagebrush. He also had a knack for getting things done. Within a day of his arrival, he had his construction crews building his new, ultimate pleasure palace.
George appreciated the new confidence that Tex had in his abilities, but he had no idea where he was going to find an orchestra. Some of the older mining towns had informal brass bands that most often gathered to play at a lodge member's funeral, but in 1907, there was no professional orchestra in the state of Nevada. George knew a few fiddlers who sometimes played tunes at hoedowns and barn dances, but still not an orchestra. And Tex had been emphatic that he needed an orchestra to open his new place. He had even ordered formal dress clothes for the musicians. "They have to look good," he explained. After his initial panic, George solved his problem in a very novel way. He had once worked in the saloons of Elko, and he knew a musician there who had worked at the Nevada Industrial School for Boys. The reformatory sought to bring former ruffians and boys seemingly bound for a criminal career back into productive lives in civil society. Maybe, just maybe, some of those boys might know how to play a musical instrument. George immediately took a train to Reno and then another on to Elko. Once there, he learned that some of the boys currently at the school had played some musical instruments at some time. When he asked whether any of the residents wanted to join a professional orchestra, George had 9 takers. Unfortunately, only 3 of the volunteers had ever actually played a musical instrument before. But with those 9 volunteers, George began to practice and teach and practice and teach. After a week, the motley group could play some music, sort of. George paid the school superintendent a special fee to use the boys and took them back with him to the instant town of Rawhide. He promised the boys $5 a week and free room and board. Supplemented by a couple of professional musicians that he had found, and with George himself on the piano keyboard. The orchestra performed at the elegant gala opening for Tex's Rawhide Northern Saloon. George said they were nicht sehr gut, but they improved over time. Playing the same tunes over and over and over helped to speed the process. As Tex or one of his several partners opened yet another new place on Stingery Gulch, George would assign a couple of his original musicians to work with a new group. Eventually, George had 8 or 9 orchestras playing music in the Gulch, and he actively moved musicians around as needed. Only one of his original 9 reform school boys ever got into any trouble. He was caught stealing a gold necklace from one of the madams and so was shot by one of the enforcers. He lived, but George did not think that he was ever caught stealing again. One of the 9 original reform school musicians may have gone on to form his own swing-era band. Once in the 30s, George heard an orchestra on the radio and the orchestra leader had the same name as one of George's original boys. But George was not sure, maybe not. The first night that George spent in Rawhide was the night of the big fire on the 4th of September, 1908. He was playing at the Rawhide Northern Saloon when he began to hear the fire bells clang. First, company number 3 of the volunteer fire department was called, then, a few minutes later, company number 1, then company number 2, and finally Fire Company No. 4. Every available resource was thrown against the fast-moving, all-consuming fire. George later learned that one of the first buildings to go was the Ross Hotel, where he had been staying. It swept from the Ross Hotel, up Nevada Street, destroying every building on one side. Then, it jumped to the other. It initially skipped over the brick-clad structures, but then the winds changed and it came back around to burn them. Finally, in order to stop the inferno, dynamite was used to blow up buildings that could not be saved. The result of the big fire was that a 9-block area of downtown Rawhide was utterly destroyed. 27 stores, 6 banks, 3 hotels, the post office, 2 Western Union telegraph offices, a huge lumber yard, and the multi-story lawyers building, where many of the mining companies had their headquarters. The destruction was valued at over $1 million. All destroyed by a single, wind-blown, window curtain, that briefly touched, if so briefly, a gasoline heater. While the commercial downtown suffered near complete devastation, the sinful enterprises of the Stingery Gulch were left practically untouched. Only Tex Rickert's original Rawhide Northern Saloon suffered fire damage. But before the fire was even out, Rickert was signing contracts with contractors and painters to reopen it. After the night of firefighting was over, everyone moved up the gulch to have a few wet ones and to celebrate the bravery of the crews of the 4 fire companies. In a few short months, Rawhide's downtown was completely rebuilt.
Tex Rickert had a knack for seeing big, even in a place like Rawhide where there was literally nothing but sagebrush. He also had a knack for getting things done. Within a day of his arrival, he had his construction crews building his new, ultimate pleasure palace. Within 2 weeks, his crews were working on a second, and by the end of the month, they had started a third and fourth. Stingery Gulch's time had begun. However, the gulch's respectable neighbor, the town of Rawhide, had only a short lifespan, barely over 6.5 years, by some reckoning. News reports had claimed that Rawhide would be the West's largest strike ever. Investors stood in long lines to buy its mining stocks. We now know that much of the town's boom was a result of promoters' hype and swindlers' artifice. The amount of actual gold taken from Rawhide's mines was incredibly small. Stock from phony and non-productive mines was sold again and again, for ever higher prices. Finally, reality emerged from behind the curtain, and Rawhide's boom became a bust. The West's last big strike was a phony. Always seeming to be ahead of the game, Tex Rickert was on to another venture well before the bust arrived. Tex Rickert was the sole promoter of the so-called Fight of the Century. The heavyweight championship that pitted the previous champion Jim Jeffries, who had never been knocked out, against the current champion. The most hated man in America, a man who taunted the country's contemporary racial expectations, Jack Johnson.
Many sports historians now believe that the idea for a Fight of the Century was originally Jack Johnson's. He had an uncanny knack for self-promotion. Even though he was unquestionably the very best fighter of his age, Johnson always had difficulty getting fights. Especially fights that paid him what he thought he was worth. He was too good. And he was too black. He had heard it often in the saloons. Some big mouth would say, if Jim Jeffries were still fighting, he'd show Jack Johnson something. Some other near drunk would echo the sentiment. Yeah, Jimmy Jeff was the best fighter ever. Never been knocked out. Jack Johnson knew there was money in a fight with old Jeff. Real money. Problem is that Jeffries is enjoying his retirement down on his farm. He has no desire to get back into the ring. Tex Rickert and Jack Johnson were friends. They had gone hunting together. They also had gone sporting together, hitting 20 San Francisco brothels in one night. At a time of intense racial segregation, it was an unusually close friendship. Tex is known to have purchased the black champ's wife an expensive fur coat and then to have told her that it was a gift from Johnson. Tex also advanced Johnson $25,000, handed off in a bag filled with $100 bills, and told him there was no need to repay it. A number of boxing promoters approached Jack Johnson about the proposed fight with Jim Jeffries. In exchange for the so-called advance, Johnson tipped Tex about the details about the proposals from other boxing promoters. Tex Rickert got the fight of the century for $5 more than his closest competitor. The national sporting press had come to intensely dislike Jack Johnson. To a large measure, this was because Johnson was black, but it was also due to the fact that he was so good. He did not just win fights, he wholly dominated his opponents. As a result, the sports press saw in Jack Johnson an arrogance and smugness that they came to hate. They clamored for someone to stand up to him, someone who would put him back in his proper place. The boxing writers clamored for the now retired, former champion, Jim Jeffries, to return to the ring, to return honor and pride to the white man's race. It was into those dark and turbulent waters that Tex Rickert stepped when he decided to promote the fight of the century. But, he reasoned, the profits would be enormous.
The fight was held on July 4th in Reno, Nevada, and it was the major sporting event of the year. Ringside tickets were said to cost $1,000. Over 200 reporters attended the fight and posted stories about it. It was one of the very first events to be caught in whole on the newsreels. From that one fight, Tex Rickert may have made over $1 million. This was before the income tax, and many of Rickert's deals were either behind the scenes or under the table, so no one knows for sure.
The first, and most necessary, step was to get Jim Jeffries out of retirement and back into the ring. However, Jeffries was not too keen on the prospect. Only an upfront guarantee of the equivalent of $3.5 million in today's money persuaded him to do so. He began his training regime by losing 100 pounds, but he could not regain the speed and stamina that once was his. In the run-up to the fight, Jack Johnson continued to show his cockiness and confidence. He was available to the press all the time, and his picture was in the papers practically every day. However, the publicity had a strong backlash, and racial tensions ran high in the days before the fight. The fight was on the 4th of July, a day that the whole nation had off and was able to focus on the fight. Millions and millions of dollars were bet, most of it on the white guy. The odds were 2.5 to 1 in Jeffries' favor. Tex took many of these bets himself, knowing that Jack Johnson could easily beat the now retired and out of shape White Hope. Tex Rickert built a special arena in downtown Reno that seated 20,000 spectators. He invited movie crews to film the fight and had six different Western Union operators telegraphing blow-by-blow descriptions of the fight. Modern scholars now think the fight of the century reached at least 60 million people. For Tex Rickert, It was a magnificent success.
George's involvement with the Johnson-Jeffries fight was minimal. He was still in Stingaree Gulch coordinating the various musical orchestras that were continuing to perform. He knew almost none of the organizational details about the big prize fight. So George was very surprised to receive Rickard's telegram saying, "Come to Reno. Need you to be timekeeper for fight." For the fight of the century, George brought his own $300 pocket watch. It had a Swiss movement and was said to be accurate to less than 1 second per year. Unlike the earlier fight in Goldfield, the heavyweight championship was relatively short, lasting only 15 rounds. Jack Johnson was the far superior fighter. He knocked Jim Jeffries down twice, and seemed to be able to pummel Jeffries at will. Finally, in the 15th round, the Jeffries corner threw in the towel. They knew their fighter was spent. Going another round would probably mean that he would be knocked out. The team wanted to preserve Jim Jeffries' record. In complete elation, Tex Rickard whacked George on the back and told him, "Great job." Later, he handed George an envelope with a little bonus in it. Rickard had given George another $5,000. In 1910, no athlete was more detested than Jack Johnson. He flaunted the racial expectations of the dominant Jim Crow society. He was often photographed with white women draped on his arms. He wore fine clothes and rode in fancy automobiles. He displayed an in-your-face smugness. July 4th prize fight, race riots erupted in 25 states and in over 50 cities. Some of the most serious rioting occurred in New York City, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, New Orleans, Atlanta, St. Louis, Little Rock, and Houston. White mobs attacked blacks with beatings, burning homes, and lynchings. One financial consequence of the race riots was that many losing bets were never paid off. The bookies and the gamblers who had taken the bets were left holding worthless markers. Some gamblers blamed Tex Rickard and demanded that he pay the unpaid bets. Of course, Rickard refused. The next year, Tex found it convenient to travel to Paraguay and invest in a cattle ranch down there.
While Tex probably sold off his interests in the Gulch to pay some of the various gambling syndicates' losses, he most likely already knew what the general public did not yet know. Rawhide was a mining town without miners. Its income had come from selling stocks. More accurately, its income came from selling stocks, then reselling the same stocks, and then reselling them again and again. There is no real evidence that Tex actually participated in the many stock scams. That was neither his style nor his game. But, all he had to do was to look at how his customers dressed. Ankle-high engineer boots, polished, not scuffed. Business suits manufactured in Chicago. White western ties. And the tan Nevada hat that we would soon see so often in the western movies. These were not men going into the supposedly deep rock mines and extracting ore. He could also listen to what they said. A seam 15 feet wide and going deep. Ore that came out at 42% high grade. Nuggets the size of a man's fist. Tex knew bullcrap when he heard it. He had once been a real cowboy in Texas. He had also heard similar talk in the Yukon. He had heard the big talk about unbelievable wealth, and had chosen not to believe it. More money in selling a man a shot of rot-gut whiskey, and then another, just to keep him bragging. Stingery Gulch, the sinful, pleasure palace had made real money. The respectable town of Rawhide was just a sham.
Taking the $5,000 bonus, George decided to leave Nevada and head east. He landed in East Orange, New Jersey, where he worked in a bookstore for several years. He found a city job working in the city's public library, in the early 1920s. He told me that when World War I broke out and the country was swept with anti-German hatred, he thought it more than convenient to change his name from Gustav Hulpira to George New last name. In 1929, George married a woman who also worked at the city library. In real pain, he exclaimed, "Oh, oh, det woman. She word crazy, crazy, I say." Finally, after the Second War, I could take it no more. She word so crazy. And, I said, half expecting a revelation of murder or mayhem. I got under train and went west. When I come here, I get off. Been here, right here since 1946. Yeah, I now got me religion again.